Pleased to have our Associate Dean for Academic Formation and Programs, Lacey Warner. She's also our Associate Professor of the Practice of Evangelism and Methodist Studies, Royce and Jane Reynolds Teaching Fellow, to introduce our speaker, Lacey Warner.
Good afternoon. It's wonderful to see all of you. Let me just tell you a little bit about the Hickman Lecture. The Hickman Lecture, the bequest was made in 1966. I'm a historian. Did you get that? So we're going to honor tradition for one moment.
Together.
All right. Well, Dr. Hickman joined the Divinity School faculty in 1927, just a year after the Divinity School was founded. He was one of the pioneers. Hickman was the first of Duke's preachers to the university and the first dean of Duke University Chapel. So these lectures actually reflect a commitment to an innovative witness of the gospel in the midst of a complex world, even from 1966. Many significant figures have delivered these lectures, such as Martin Marty, Peter Gomes, Lovett Weems, Barbara Brown Taylor, and today we welcome Rob Bell, who echoes and demonstrates these continued innovative commitments. Rob Bell is the author of many books featured in videos, including the Pneuma series. He is a popular Christian speaker and the founder of Mars Hill Bible Church in Grand Rapids. A graduate of Wheaton and Fuller, I have this quote. You can deny it. But according to a, you can do whatever you want, actually. If it's okay with you, yeah. Okay, I'm almost done, I promise. According to Bell, quoted in an interview, you didn't receive very good grades in preaching by your own testimony. Because he was too innovative. I am so glad I'm not that preaching professor. But God bless him or her. So, okay, here we go.
It's a her.
Okay, I'm really almost done. Bell and his wife, Kristen, whom he met at Wheaton, moved to Grand Rapids to minister before planting a new community of faith in 1999 called Mars Hill, after the Greek site where the Apostle Paul found an altar with the inscription "To an unknown God," and as you all know, stated, "Now what you worship as something unknown, I will proclaim to you." So among his published works are Velvet Elvis, Sex God, Jesus Wants to Save Christians, and Drops Like Stars. Bell is appreciated for his imaginative uses of media and communication technologies in the practice of ministry, communicating the gospel in compelling language to those disillusioned with religion, bloated with consumerism, and anxious about the complex dynamics of an uncertain world. We are so glad you're here.
Thank you. Great intro. Thank you for that introduction. I was even interested in hearing him speak by the time you were done. Hi, it's great to be with you. I've never been here to Duke, and it's really an honor and a privilege. And I just have to say up front that my original lecture that I was going to give was the redemptive significance of Lady Gaga. But after this morning, I'll give something else. In 1966, Bob Dylan was interviewed and asked the following question: what made you decide to go the rock and roll route? Bob Dylan responded, "Carelessness. I lost my one true love. Started drinking. I wind up in Phoenix. I get a job as a Chinaman. I start working in a dime store and move in with a 13-year-old. Then this big Mexican lady from Philadelphia comes in and burns the house down. I go down to Dallas. I get a job as a before and a Charles Atlas before and after ad." I I move in with a delivery boy who can cook fantastic chili and hot dogs. Then this 13-year-old girl from Phoenix comes and burns the house down. The next thing I know, I'm in Omaha. It's so cold there. By this time, I'm robbing my own bicycles and fry my own fish. I move in with a high school teacher who also does a little plumbing on the side, who ain't much to look at, but who's built a special kind of refrigerator that can turn newspaper into lettuce. Everything's going good until that delivery boy shows up and tries to knife me. Needless to say, he burned the house down, and I hit the road. First guy that picked me up asked me if I wanted to be a star. What could I say? The interviewer then asks in follow-up, and that's how you became a rock and roll singer? No, that's how I got tuberculosis. Now, let us exegete the text. What is it that makes this? How many of you, if you were to describe an emotion surrounding this, it might just be joy. It's just your confusion and your sense of what is he making this up? Yes. The confusion is trumped by just enjoyment. Why is it so great? I mean, obviously there's this very interesting thing, and if you see the interviews he did, especially in the late 60s, with all of these, are you a protest singer? Why did you plug in and play electric? And you see him, he's completely messing with the interviewer, and in the process, he's making all sorts of really brilliant statements about the very nature of celebrity. Would you agree? I mean, there's all this I assume the interviewer, like by about sentence 3 or 4, was like, I think he's totally working me over. Correct? And if you didn't, you shouldn't be interviewing Bob Dylan. At the same time, so it has a very profound, like, he is saying something. He is making, enacting, it's almost like performance art, he is enacting the absurdity, pointing out the absurdity of some of the ways in which celebrities are treated. And yet at the same time, he doesn't take himself that seriously. It's this odd blend of very profound and completely light and loose and ridiculous all at the same time. I move forward to several years ago, and the great poet Jay-Z, who said, I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. Now, JC is from the Marcy Projects of Brooklyn, very, very poor, abandoned by his father, ended up dealing drugs on the corner. Somewhere along the way, discovers that he can put words together in very fascinating, fresh, and new ways, begins recording these rap albums, is soon heralded as the greatest rapper alive, and just recently they said they believe that he's worth $500 million because of all of his business interests. So when he says, I'm a businessman, I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman, and you understand the story, and you think about hip-hop culture and American sociology in general, and you realize it's funny, and he's kind of poking fun at himself, and he's taking himself very sort of, but it's also, he's also saying quite a bit there about his tribe's experience in American culture. Are you with me? It is both two things at the same time. Several years ago, I got to do this event with Bishop Tutu and Dalai Lama. And they said, we want to put you on a stage together. And then one of the leading Muslim scholars, Ingrid Marsden, and then the leading Buddhist nun in the country, Roshi Joan Halifax. We want to put you all, and then Rabbi Rosen from Jerusalem. We want to put you on a stage and just let the crowd ask questions. Which I was like, that is a good time in the making right there. So before the event, I was standing kind of here, and the Dalai Lama came from one corner of the room, and Bishop Tutu came from the other corner of the room, and they met right in front of me. And so I kind of had this front row seat, and apparently they've been friends for a while, and when they met, do you know what they do when they haven't seen each other in a while and they meet? They meet, they embrace, and then they begin to tickle each other and giggle. I did not know this is what they do when they meet each other. And there is this moment, the one is here and the other's here, and they are embracing and giggling each other and tickling like young schoolboys. And then they sort of back up, and I'm standing here thinking, I am in one of the more surreal moments of my life. And so I did what any of you would have done. I pulled out my phone and I took a picture. This may be inappropriate, but I am capturing this moment. They then sat down and they began to talk, and I didn't know they're very, very, very funny. And so, like, at one point, literally, the Dalai Lama looks over at Bishop Tutu, and he looks at him, and he kind of squints, and then he says, "Have you gained weight?" This is the kind of banter. And then Bishop Tutu spontaneously launched into this little mini sermon about how God, the prophet Isaiah says, is like a mother who cannot forget the young that she has birthed from her womb. God will not forget us in our suffering, in the oppression that we face, in the injustice in the world. God is like a mother who cannot forget the child that she has nursed. And he gets done with this speech. God is like a mother. And he gets done. And the Dalai Lama says, "Your view of God is so refreshing." And they begin to have this sort of discussion. And they giggle and they laugh and they make jokes about each other's weight. And so these are two people who have seen a fair bit of suffering. Are you with me? And yet in the exact same moment, there's like this lightness. There is this joy sort of percolating below the surface at the whole time. It is both heavy and light. It is two things at once. Today, what I would like to explore is both the heaviness and the lightness of following Jesus. I would call it this. There is a Eucharistic paradox at the heart of Jesus' invitation to follow him. Now, if you're thinking to yourself, you aren't familiar with the term Eucharistic paradox, it's because I made it up. I'm glad you enjoyed that. There is this paradox at the heart of Jesus' invitation to follow him. Now, Eucharist means E-U, good, and charis is where we get the word gift or grace, the good gift. And so we as followers of Jesus understand that Jesus is God's good gift to us for the healing and salvation of the world. And how does this gift work? Well, Jesus says it this way. He's with his disciples. "This is my body. This is my blood." He gives himself. His body is broken and his blood is poured out for our healing, reconciliation, and salvation. And so Jesus is God's good gift to us. And the way that the gift works is his body is broken and his blood is poured out. And so our invitation then to follow him, to trust him, to believe in him, to be his people, is then to go into the world as a living, breathing Eucharist. We have received the gift of this body broken and this blood poured out. We have the literal Eucharist, the table, the experience, the communion, the supper. But then that becomes a metaphor, that becomes a sort of enactment of the ways in which we then see our role in the world. Church, a local church, a community of Jesus followers, is a Eucharist for the world around them. And so our bodies are broken and our blood is poured out for the healing of the world. That's how it works. Are you with me? When some people talk about church mission and strategery and all sorts of things, maybe the first question is just, what does it mean for our church to be a Eucharist for the city, the neighborhood, the area that we live in? What does it mean for us to see ourselves? We are here. We are a gift. Sometimes people say, "Do you believe in spiritual gifts?" Yes, you are one. What does it mean for us to have our body broken and our blood poured out? What does it mean for us to give ourselves as a gift to this? Not in a sort of pompous, "Look at the gift that we are bringing you," but as a humble, broken gift to the world around us. That under-resourced school needs people to help fourth graders learn how to read because we've discovered a direct link between literacy rates among fourth graders and the population of the local jail. And if kids read at a certain level by age 7 or 8 or 9, then what they've discovered is that this many years later, the rate of crime simply drops among that age group. Well, then maybe for our church, one of the gifts that we give is we simply help kids learn to read. 1 in 8 or 1 in 7 people in the world don't have fresh access to clean drinking water. Then perhaps we ought to help get people drinking water because Jesus said to. What does it mean to be a gift to our world? And so there is the Eucharist, this way of understanding who we are in the world. It costs something. It can be hard. And yet it is also, at the same time, something else. What I'd like today to explore with you, my central thesis is that there's this Eucharistic paradox, is I want to explore that it is both heavy and light. It is both passionate commitment and devotion, and it is held loosely. It is both intense, and it takes everything that you have. Those of you who are pastors, you know exactly what I'm talking about, having your body broken and your blood poured out so that these people you've been entrusted with might have life. Are you with me? It is both heavy, and yet it is also to be light. So I want to explore this paradox. First, I want to talk about one of the first sermons that I ever gave. I was invited, I was probably 25-ish, and I was interning with a pastor who I absolutely adored. And what I discovered that an intern is, that an intern works twice as many hours for half as much money, and that as an intern, what you do is you do everything that the pastor that you report to doesn't want to do. So, and I mean this with all love and adoration. And so he was asked to speak at a revival at a county fairgrounds on a Saturday morning. And for some strange reason, he said no. God wasn't calling him to that. So I went. Now, I was like 25. I've probably preached 5 or 6 sermons in my life. And so I go up to the county fairgrounds. And when I get there and I sort of get a lay of the land, I am struck with a couple of things. First off, there was a horse racing track at the county fairgrounds. Should have seen that one coming. Now, you can see this white box there. That was the stands for the spectators who watch the horse and running races. Now, what they decided to do is they could have put the stage where the preacher, moi, gave the message right in front of the front row, like, oh, this room. But somebody decided, no. Let's put the stage on the infield across the horse racing track from the crowd. Okay. So, and then it, I swear to you, there were 13 people there. It was like a revival, but no one invited the spirit. You know what I mean? It was just... It was, and apparently there was some sort of rule that you aren't allowed to sit within 20 feet of the nearest person. So I walk in, and there, I mean, it must have seat 500 or 1,000, and there's like 13 people. You could have shot a gun, and everybody would have been safe. Like, there's just, so there are people like here, 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 here. It's like all for the unity of the body. And so that's just, and then there's a stage that I mentioned, across the horse racing track. So before I speak, they take me out onto the stage, and before I speak, there's going to be some special music, which depends on your perspective, I guess. If special equals I remembered it, fair play. So there's a keyboard player, and there's a bass player, and a song leader, and so I go and get on the stage, and the stage has a tarp roof on it in case there was a hailstorm or something, but it was installed by hobbits, and it rubs on my head. So I get up on the stage, and there's this sort of thing, and they begin playing. This is the best thing ever. This is the keyboard goes out. So they sing hymns to just a bass. Like, what key are we in? You know what I mean? Dogs are barking three counties over. It's just this. So then I get up to speak, and it's just not right. There's just this, and there's people. And so I want to be close. Just, and somebody, they also, across the front of the stage, had put like a fence, like a picket fence for some reason. So I think, I need to get closer to the people. So I step and I jump over the fence, down onto the track, and I walk right up to the front of the stands to speak to the people and to bring the word of God. I open my Bible, not realizing that I am in a ferocious wind tunnel, and all of my notes, and 9 years of therapy later, I made peace with the event. There is this paradox in which you absolutely, totally throw yourself into it. And you also find out that there is a wind you hadn't planned on, and it's not going how it was supposed to. How many know exactly what? You have been standing there watching your notes, and then the thought occurs, maybe I should chase after my notes, get them, and keep running. There is this paradox in which there's a great degree to which you don't have control. You don't. Especially if you're new and you're starting out in this, or you're a seminary student, and you're just, there is an illusion that there's this whole thing that you can control. It's not true. You give everything you have to it, and at the same moment, if you do not let it go and hold it loosely, you are in trouble. Are you with me? There, it is both heavy and light. It is both intense and demands that you give everything to it, and at the same time, your hands are open, and it is a gift freely given. Next slide. How many of you have had this? You worked and worked and worked and worked on the sermon because you were like, that sermon, man, angels are going to come through the roof. And you gave it, and it was crickets. It's like, when I was in my study working on this, it was awesome. And then there is that other message that you worked on, and you had 2 funerals, 4 hospital visits, a wedding, and your 1-year-old was throwing up. Not that I know what we're talking about here. And so you basically came in Sunday to the pulpit with this limp little bird you found by the side of the road. You duct taped its wings back onto it. And it's all you had. And so you just, this thing was such a limp, lame, no power, no real study, you just don't have that space in your heart right now, that you literally took the cop out of the end of your sermon and you said, now I could wrap this up, but I sense we're just supposed to sit in silence. Right, that's the level. And the other one, the one that was awesome, the one that when you were in office working on it, you were like, okay, there's going to be some serious repentance on this one. Oh, man. That one, people, was like crickets. It was like, it raised the profound question, what's for lunch? But then this other one, this little wet, soggy bird with no mommy, you put that into the room, and someone afterward walks up, and they're like, oh, man, that was the most awesome thing I've ever heard. I mean, you're like, no, that was a homiletical turd, is what that was. How many of you know exactly what I'm talking about? Yes. It's like you give everything you have, and yet in the same moment, this is my gift. This is what I have. Or how about this one? If you've been pastoring a church for a while and somebody comes up after you and they say something, how many of you had this? They come up afterwards and they say something to you and you find yourself thinking, have you heard one thing I have said? And this actually, the laws on this, the longer you've been in one church, this, how many of you had this exact experience? Where, look, true story. Man comes up to me like a year ago. We planted our church 11 years ago. A year ago, a man comes up. I don't know how many sermons I've talked about restoration, renewal, reconciliation. The Bible ends here. This earth, this is our home. Let's take care of it because that's the only home we got. But the man comes up to me. How many times have I talked about those destructive evacuation theologies? How many times? Guy walks up to me. Leader. Holds out his Bible and says to me, Bible. Oh, interesting. Bible. Basic instructions before leaving Earth. Are you trying to tear my heart out because it's working? That's just a moment when you think, have you heard anything I've said? When you lead, when you step up, when you say something, do something, manage something, organize something, when you insist that there is a direction we are to go, when you wade into something murky and complicated and say, I think we ought to consider this plan of action. I think we ought to consider no plan of action. We ought to sit in silence and just listen for a whole year on this one. When you do this, when you put that microphone on, when you enter into that room, when you say yes to that task, when you go through that education in order to be ordained there so you can do that, you open yourself up to a world of possible outcomes. I might say it like this. You open yourself up to misunderstanding and confusion and anger and ignorance and fear and jealousy and opinions and evaluation and critique and agendas and baggage and convictions and projections and blogging and the Official Committee for Doctrinal Purity and Theological Correctness, self-appointed, of course. And also, at the same time, you open yourself up to the possibility that there will be hope and light and repentance and desire and compassion and longing and revolution. Confession and inspiration and comfort and solidarity and salvation and resurrection. Are you with me now? And if you want the one, if you want to be an agent through which God flows for the one, then you have to run the risk that the other is going to come your way. And if you cling to this gift that you've given too tightly, if your worth, your identity, your value, your self-esteem is too tied in to how this gift is received, you will find extraordinary pain associated with that white knuckling of the gift. You both put yourself out there and you rip open your rib cage and you say, here, and then at the same time, you let it go and it's going to be what it's going to be. And there's a great degree to which you cannot control that. It is what it is. And the Eucharistic paradox is that Jesus invites us to both give it all away and throw ourselves into it, and in the very same breath, hold it incredibly lightly. This means taking this extraordinary seriously and at the same time taking yourself not that seriously. I'm not a businessman, I'm a businessman. This is an art. If somebody, when I started out, would have told me that, all that stuff you read about plans and seven steps and all that, rubbish. Helpful, also rubbish. Because the gift doesn't necessarily work that way. Next slide. I might say this. Now, if that doesn't say Wheaton College for Christ and His Kingdom, I don't know what does. Yeah, Alumni Magazine's a little hesitant to publish that one. Now, I was in college. I went to Wheaton College, and I was in this band, and my friends and I thought we were going to be like the next great saviors of rock and roll. And my senior year of college, we had a bunch of gigs lined up at these clubs in Chicago, and we were like, that's it, we're going to get our name out there, and this is all going to go there. That week on a Friday night, I got a brain infection. I started to have a horrible headache, like I think this is more than just a headache. And throughout the night, I literally would beat my head on the wall because that felt better than what was happening to my brain. And finally, I just asked my roommates. I've never been to the hospital, never broken a bone. I said, I think I need to go to the hospital. So I went to the hospital and learned that I had a brain infection, viral meningitis. The fluid around my brain had become infected and swollen up and was essentially squeezing my brain against the walls of my skull, which years later, to say I once had a brain infection gets you out of all sorts of things. Nevertheless, I ended up in the hospital and had to leave school for a number of weeks, and just, it was, I had no energy, like no energy. And I remember in my 20-year-old state laying in the hospital room, and what I knew about God was, there must be something in this, so just tell me what it is. You have my attention, was basically the only prayer I could muster. Whatever it is, I'm listening. And soon after that, this band sort of broke up and fell apart, and I, through a whole series of events, including random people saying, have you thought about being a pastor? I'll pursue this pastor urge, which is somehow welled up in the midst of all of this great pain and confusion. And after that, that would have been right after I graduated, I was teaching barefoot water skiing at this camp in Wisconsin, and somehow they were planning a chapel service, and I was like, oh, I'll give the message. What was that? And I remember getting up to give this message, and I'd never done anything like this. I had no idea how you prepare. I had no idea. All I remember is the first thing I did was tell a story about a kid being hung in a tree by his underwear. I mean, that was like that kind of level of homiletics I was at. And I got up and was overwhelmed with a sense that I was on holy ground and that my life was never going to be the same again. It was like that. It might as well be written on that wall. It was that clear. And I took off my sandals in this moment of nothing is ever going to be the same again. I'm supposed to do something with this book, with people, and somehow bringing life around this Jesus. It was like that. It was like that. There. Do that, and I'll take care of the rest. That was essentially the closest to an audible voice somewhere in my heart, however that works. Just do this. Everything will be fine. And so I stand before you 20 years later, and that's actually turned out to be true. Stick to this. You're going to be fine. So for some of us, the Eucharist calling, how are you to be broken and poured out, comes in moments where nothing will ever be the same again. Something happens within us. Frederick Buechner calls it where the world's greatest need meets your greatest passion. Boom, we have something. I kind of added my own bit to the end of his bit. That's what happened to me. And nothing ever was the same again. And to this day, I'm more passionate about this than ever. For other people, the Eucharist calling, how are you going to be broken open and poured out, comes in very different ways. Some people who would never even drag Jesus into it actually teach us all sorts of things. This is a river. This is a bridge in China in a city called Nanjing. It goes over the Yangtze River. It's a very, very famous bridge. It's 4 miles across, and it's famous for the number of people who have jumped off of it to kill themselves. Like, unbelievable numbers. And so this bridge has become famous as a suicide bridge. There are stories of husbands and wives holding hands and then jumping. Like, that's what this bridge is known for. There's a man named Mr. Chen in Nanjing who began to read about these numbers and said, that is not right. Here's a picture of Mr. Chen. That's all they know from the media is his name is Mr. Chen. And so he decided, every waking moment when I am not working, I am going to be on that bridge stopping people from jumping off. So he has become famous because these are two people actually that he saved on either side of him. He wears binoculars. He dresses warmly, and he paces the bridge every waking moment when he is not at his job. According to his calculations so far, he has stopped 174 people. I sometimes wonder if that's an excellent way to describe the Eucharist life Jesus calls us to. There's a bridge. There are people jumping off it. Somebody ought to do something about it. The somebody is me. Sometimes to get at what that is simply, what is it that you see and you think, who's going to do something about that? And the question bounces back. You. You. In churches, when people say, what are we doing about? Remember that in church language, if you were to translate that, that person is saying, I am volunteering to. Why don't we ever do anything? What I'm hearing, Charlie Barr's mom, what I'm hearing you say is that you are volunteering to that, and I am thrilled to support you in your calling. That's sometimes it is just a, it is you finally, you find the thing that you think, I could get up every morning to do this. Sometimes you see something and there is an urgency, someone should do something about that, and the somebody is me. Next slide. This is a bike. A friend of mine named Joey Ritter, he's an industrial designer, and he began by asking the question, is a bike too complicated? Could a bike be simpler? So he began conceptually saying, I'm going to strip away every single thing and only add the things that are absolutely necessary to propel yourself on two wheels. So you can see he got rid of handlebars and just put two handles on the steering column. He then put the pedals, like a unicycle, on the back wheel, and then just one simple tube like that. Sometimes I think some people's calling is to ask, is this thing too complicated? Could this be more simple and straightforward? And so bureaucracies and institutions and systems get built around certain things. Certain people, their calling is to charge in and go, too much, too much, too much, too much. Strip it down. Get back to essence. Other people, if I would have said to you, one of the biggest music groups in the world several years ago, here's what they're going to be. The one of the biggest musical groups in the world is going to be two people from Detroit in their mid-20s. They are going to have, no one's going to know whether they're brother and sister or they were once married. They're only going to wear white, red, and black. She is going to play the drums loudly but kind of messily, and he is going to only play fiberglass guitars that Sears made in the 40s with no effects on them whatsoever, and they're going to become one of the biggest bands in the world. You'd go, no, it doesn't work like that. But the White Stripes actually did that. Let's have there only be two of us. No bass player? No bass player. Let's use, like, old, nasty instruments, and let's only wear this. And then in interviews, let's not actually tell whether we're married or we're brother and sister or some other sort of questionable situation. And it'll be huge. It'll catch on. All the kids will dig it. Some people, their gift is they see something no one else sees. And if you were to describe it, you'd be like, no. And then you see it, and you go, yeah, yeah, that kind of works in a strange sort of way. Years ago, 2003, I had this growing body of content that I thought, I think this is a book. I think I have a book here. I had these notes kind of in my computer. And so I thought, well, I know what I'll do. I'll get a really good writer to take these ideas and write them up. So I took some sermons and gave them to this writer, like the recordings, and said, could you take these sermons and then could you like type them up and make like chapters out of them? And so she did that, and I read it, and I was like, who is this? This doesn't work. So I thought, well, that's the problem, because it's not my voice. So I hired a court stenographer. You know, the person who, like, types all the records in a church? Like, I'll just speak the book, and then I'll take... So for a whole day, I talked straight, and I just talked the whole book, and a guy typed it, and then I paid him, and then he gave me what he'd typed up. And I was like, this is awful. And I remember this moment when I realized... And you're going to be like, duh. The only way to write a book is I'm going to have to write a book. I'm going to have to sit down and stare at a blank screen, and then I'm going to actually have to type the words. And it is then that I discovered what Gene Fowler learned a long time ago. Writing is easy. All you do is sit staring at a blank sheet of paper until drops of blood form on your forehead. This is what I learned I learned that it only works if you break yourself open and you pour yourself out. There aren't any ways around it. And that is the myth of the shortcut, and it comes to us in a thousand different ways. There is a way that you can lead those people without actually being present with them. No. There is a way you can hide over here. There is a way you cannot give it everything you got, and everything will be fine. It won't be fine. And the Eucharist paradox is that Jesus calls us to both break ourselves open and pour ourselves out, to give everything we have, and in the same moment, to hold it so loosely with such joy and a freedom and a lightness that comes from a gift freely given. Jesus says two things which I think embody what I'm trying to get at here. Take up your cross and follow me. A cross was heavy, literally, but a cross was heavy. And my yoke is easy and my burden is light. Now, if I were to ask you, well, which is it? Which is it? The only proper answer, of course, is yep. Yep. Are you with me? Yeah. Yeah, that's how it works. Pick up your cross, and my yoke is easy. And if we shortchange it in either direction, something very destructive and life-destroying happens. There are a couple dimensions that I think make this absolutely important for us. First, there will always be critics. I saw this piece in an art show recently. This is by Lisa Murch. It's called Invasion. And they're all like coming out of the wall at you. How many of you are like, oh yeah, that's an elder meeting? How many of you know this picture? Not know Lisa Murch and her piece and vision, but you know what this picture at that other level. That sense that they're coming at you, that they want something. Or the simple universal truth, sheep have teeth. And one of the reasons it's so absolutely vital that we understand that we are invited into a Eucharistic paradox is the only way to survive that is you have given this gift and you are able to hold the outcome very loosely. Because if your worth, your identity, your ego, your esteem, or more importantly, your sense of accomplishment, and even more importantly, your calling. If your calling is wrapped up on keeping the fish at bay, then you're endlessly roller coasting through, should I even be doing this? That's a separate question, and there's a time and a place for a clearing committee and discernment and wise counsel, but we will only be able to bear what comes our way if we have come to understand that I gave this gift, I gave everything I have, and this is simply part of it. When we are holding tightly to the outcome, even the smallest criticism can be absolutely crushing. Are you with me? And sometimes I think it isn't the criticism, it's the echo. My experience has been, it isn't the thing that person said, like, man, that guest teacher, I mean, for the first time in a while, I really got something out of it. Because there's a part of us that says, oh, you should be strong, let it bounce off. Those are just people expressing their thing. It's great that they actually could. It isn't that. It's when you're driving home and it's 4 hours later when you're out mowing your lawn and you're still replaying that comment. It isn't the initial little paper cut. It's the head games that says, I should be able to blow that off and I can't. How many of you know that thing? It isn't the initial thing, because you can, like, and your friends are like, oh, don't take them too seriously. They're mentally unstable. Oh, you're right. Okay. but they said it about me, not you. How many of you have a really helpful friend, but it's not them, it's you? So I'll just blow that off. Yeah, but it's 2 days later, and it's like ping-ponging in my brain. Only it's the gift freely given. That's one of the things that comes away. That's part of it. But when we enter into this, and we give it everything we have, and at the same exact moment we let it go, we are in a much better place to handle some of the things that will come this way. Critics. Secondly, failure. In their brilliant book, Art and Fear, David Bayless and Ted Orland tell the story of a ceramics teacher. And the ceramics teacher took the class and divided the class into two halves. And to the one half of the class, the ceramics teacher said, "Your job in the given amount of time is to create as much sculpture as you possibly can." To the other half of the class, the ceramics teacher said, "Your job is to create the single best piece of sculpture that you can." At the end of the given amount of time, the two halves of the class came back together. And what happened is the half that had been assigned to make the most amount of sculpture also made the single best pieces. Bales and Orland then say this. Apparently, that while the quantity group was busy churning out piles of work and learning from their mistakes, the quality group had sat theorizing about perfection and in the end had little more to show for their efforts than grandiose theories and a pile of dead clay. And then they say this. What every artist must learn is that even the failed pieces are essential. I wish somebody would have told me this a long time ago. Part of the Eucharistic gift, when you actually step out and you give yourself and you pour your heart out and you give it away, is that you will speak sometimes too soon, sometimes not speak enough, rush too fast, too slow. And when we are too busy holding on and white-knuckling the outcomes, the failures can absolutely crush us. But the mystery of the Eucharist is that God takes blood and rejection and a spear in the side and the abandonment of disciples and takes, my God, why have you forsaken me? Takes the whole big mess and out of it makes something beautiful. And when you cling too tightly to this, and when you beat yourself up for your failures, and when your worth and value and your sense of, am I even good enough in this? Is God even with me? Is the present? When it's all tied up in the outcomes, it can drain the life right out of you because there's no way to deal with the failures because that's what they're seen as, failures. But nothing is wasted in God's economy. And when you understand the Eucharistic gift in light of the larger Eucharistic gift, then failures get swallowed up. Wow, check that out. Now we know what not to do. When you hold it looser, then you're able to hold it looser. You are able to, probably should not do that again. That actually had some life in it. That, nope. And you are able to have it take its proper place. And then when you get farther down the road, you can even look back and those things that you would flog yourself for over and over again, you begin to see them in a whole new way. Wow, we survived even that. It did not kill us. I think we're actually a bit stronger. There's outcomes. There are the critics. There are the failures. And then one more thought. My experience has been is that an extraordinary number of leaders are exhausted. My experience has been that the Western church culture gave people some sort of machine production understanding that you just got to crank it out. The youth pastor is told how many were there last week. And loaded within that question are 1,000 assumptions going all the way back to the youth pastor's paycheck. Are you with me? And so the idea of it being sustainable, the idea that it's not just survival. I hope I'm still here in 3 years, but in 3 years, I want to have more life and be more passionate about this. In my experience, there are lots and lots and lots of religious leaders, especially Christian pastors, who signed up for a revolution and are now managing a spiritual business. And somewhere along the way, that original Eucharistic nudge got lost in being a part of this giant machine that turns a crank and produces whatever apparently it's supposed to produce for the powers that be. What this means very directly is that when you ask pastors, what day of the week is your email turned off? What is the day of the week if I were to call you, I wouldn't be able to get a hold of you because you were busy being? Where are the periods in your calendar, in your week, in your day, when I can't get to you because you're goofing off with your kids who don't care how big your church is? They don't care. On behalf of all the kids here, they don't care. They want to know where you are. Period. And my experience has been it's often rooted in an inability to give everything you have and then get in your car and drive home. And so it's held heavy and tightly, and then it's also held heavy and tightly. The art is that you give your very best. You would be broken open and poured out, and yet in that very same breath, you would be able to say, no, I'm not available for the next several days. Here is the mystery of the Eucharist. If somebody receives, then somebody else gave. If somebody was blessed, somebody else did the blessing. And this is why sometimes you are tired and you can't articulate the exhaustion. You just know you're really tired. It's like you're tired, but it's like there's a gauge on your dashboard that you don't know what that gauge is. You just know it's really low. That is because the act of Eucharist is to break yourself open and pour yourself out. And if you do not balance that act with a corresponding act of allowing yourself to be filled and put back together, it will not be sustainable. You will then have to give less and less of a gift because you realize over time, oftentimes intuitively without articulating it, that this is taking something from me, and if I go the whole way here, I'm not going to be able to keep all of the other balls in the air. Are you with me? I've met pastors who don't take all of their vacation days. Sin. Repent. What are you thinking? The art is to understand, when you do a funeral, that is breaking yourself open and pouring yourself out. And if there is not a corresponding period of silence, rest, retreat, and whatever it is that feeds your soul, and don't ever apologize for it, where the body is put back together and the blood is poured back in. When my wife and I began to practice a Sabbath, we did it on Saturdays because I had something going on Sundays, and we would find ourselves, literally by Saturday afternoon, we would find ourselves depressed. We realized, and this took a number of years to articulate, oh, we are addicted to the ministry buzz. We are addicted to the hit, to being needed, to being wanted, to being desired, to seeing fruit. And we say all sorts of things, oh, but God's doing amazing things. And then you find yourself a couple years later so tired you can't even explain it. And it's like not just physical tired, like go away for a week and have a vacation. No, I actually went away for a week and now it's worse. It's because it's a soul Eucharistic exhaustion. And when the act is given, it must be balanced with a corresponding act or it can't be sustained. That's how the Eucharist works. Actually, if you trace the Gospels and you notice how it mentions more and more crowds, you will also notice corresponding text in which Jesus withdraws. Really, you guys had a great time and all sorts of stuff, amazing stuff happened, and the crowds were bigger than ever? Great, let's go away and rest. At the moments of which we'd be like, oh, no, 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 you had a video venue. Jesus is like, that was a joke. I hope some of you enjoyed that. That was very kind of under the radar. Later, you'd be like, that's brilliant. At the moment at which we'd be like, oh, no, 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 you add a service. Jesus is like, no, you come away and you let yourself be put back together. That is the art, to hold it and understand the heaviness of that cross and the lightness of that yoke. Both the intensity of the body broken and the blood poured out, and the soaring, exuberant, loosely held joy of the gift, all at the same time. One thought, and then we're done. There's a story told about the great Rabbi Akiva, who's walking home one night to his village in the Galilee. But it is a foggy night, and it is dark, and he misses the turnoff to his village. And he heads down the road the wrong direction, and he ends up at the Roman garrison filled with Roman soldiers in the Galilee. And he hears, as he comes up to the massive wall of the fortress, a voice shout up over the wall, "Who are you? And what are you doing here?" And Akiva pauses, and he says, "How much are they paying you?" "No, who are you? And what are you doing here?" "How much are they paying you?" What? "How much are they paying you?" "2 denarius a day." "I will give you," the rabbi says, "twice that to come to my house every morning and ask me those two questions." Are you here today and you signed up for a revolution, but you find yourself caught in some sort of system that doesn't work? And so the Eucharist invitation today is to rediscover and recommit yourself to why you got yourself into the self in the first place. Find your bridge and get your binoculars. Sometimes it gets beaten out of us. And so the Eucharist invitation, sometimes what happens is we get so tired of the fish coming at us that we just back off. "I stepped out last time, and look at, I got shot at. No way am I doing that again." And so we just begin to ever so subtly pull back. "I'll give them this, but I won't give them this. Because last time." And the Eucharist invitation is to let your body be broken and your blood be poured out. It is heavy. And sometimes we make it light. "I'll just skate by, whatever, whatever." No, 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 no. Are you here today? And we need to rediscover what that is, be true to that, and then give that gift as it is properly to be given. And then secondly, is there a brother or sister here today who at some point you began to hold that thing too tightly? The outcome, criticism, the failure, the need for rest. "No, no, no, honey, I can't be home because I need to be at the church making sure that everything goes how I want it to go." And we need to do this. It's going to do what it's going to do. You can give your gift. There will be moments when your gift will turn the ship in radical new directions, and there will be moments when you find yourself thinking, "Have you heard a word I said?" The joy is in the gift. And the outcome, and when the outcomes do go gloriously well, you just then have all the more joy. But it is, at its heart, where the life is to be found. Let's have a word of prayer, shall we? God, we ask you in this space to speak to each of us what we need to hear. We pause to reflect on the paradox of the Eucharist, its heaviness and its lightness, its intensity and its exuberance. And we want to be the kinds of people, the kinds of presence in our families, neighborhoods, churches, and world, that we give this gift, we create this culture, we make these things, we do these things, we say these things, we give these things with that kind of passion and commitment and that kind of joy and lightness. We long for our churches, our brothers and sisters, for all of us to see ourselves as recipients of a good gift and as givers of a good gift. For the ways in which it has become too complicated, we ask you to show us essence and simplicity. For the ways in which we have run too fast, we ask that you would slow us down. For the ways in which we have lost that primal view of a bridge, and somebody needs to do something about that, we ask to reclaim that now. In the strong, healing, joyful name of the resurrected Jesus, everybody said, amen. It's been great being with you. Grace and peace be with you. Thanks.